Susan Stevens, and I'm here with NIU education professor Joseph Flynn to talk about racism. Yeah, well, we have to narrow that down just a little bit, so we'll do that. Joe's also an author, and his new book is White Fatigue: Rethinking Resistance for Social Justice. So let's take a hard look at how racism functions in our society and what educators can do to forge ahead with a serious national conversation on race without alienating potential allies. Easy, right? Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome, Joe. I appreciate you having me.
And by the way, our listeners may know you through your perspectives on WNIJ.
Yes.
Let's talk a little about your background just to start. You grew up in Peoria. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of exposure to black and white culture. You have a really great family. How do you think that shaped you as an educator, and especially as a social justice educator?
Well, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1970. So I was born 2 years after the assassination of Dr. King, a year, I believe, after the Loving versus Virginia decision. And so that shift, the cultural shift, hadn't quite happened yet. And we were one of the first black families in our neighborhood. However, with that being said, the kids that I played with, by and large, were all wonderful. I rarely ever felt marginalized. And so in my home, and through my family and my family's friends, I learned a lot about black culture, while through my friends, I learned a lot about white culture and was able to figure out how to represent myself depending on which environment that I was in, and bringing elements of both to each, right?
And I think one of the examples that you had that was maybe such a small example, but it seemed very powerful, was one of the stories you'd shared about being in high school. You're in the car with a bunch of kids, a bunch of your friends. You're the only black kid in the car, and they start making jokes. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah. It was a group of us boys, and we were all pretty cool with each other. And in a night of revelry on the way to a party, we all started telling jokes, and that kind of slipped into a series of racial jokes, N-word jokes to be specific. And before or after each joke, the statement, "No offense, Joe," was given. And after four or five jokes, it just got to be a little bit absurd. And I questioned them, you know, "Well, no offense to me, but what about the members of my family? What about people that I go to church with? What about, you know, people that I grew up with?" And to which, of course, no one really had an answer to that, because I don't think that they had really thought about that scope. You know, it's just a joke. But clearly in that moment, despite the fact that I was surrounded by people that I considered friends, it was no longer a joke. It was damaging. And clearly, all these years later, I still remember it like it happened yesterday. So it had a profound impact on me. But as I point out in the book, the thing that I really focus on was a good friend of mine at the time named Bobby. And the silent communication that Bobby and I had between each other in the backseat of that car spoke volumes. And you could tell that he felt uncomfortable but wasn't quite sure of what to do with it. I felt uncomfortable and wasn't quite sure of what to do. And it just, you know, I ultimately just exploded emotionally. And just thinking back to that time and thinking about how Bobby's reaction was and what was happening and his own confusion about, you know, how do you deal with something like this? It really left an indelible impact on me.
Nobody wants to be called a racist, and we're not talking about people who actually enjoy being called racists
right
today. We're talking about the vast majority, the people who want to do the right thing,
right?
Like your friend, and but didn't know what to do. It seems like not that long ago that Saturday morning cartoons, it was like the Great Melting Pot, and people still today will say, you know, "Hey, I'm colorblind,"
right?
But it's, you know, they found their peace, their comfort in those stances. But now they've got some work to do. They're finding out, you know, that's not enough.
A part of the problem is that I don't think that nationally, as a culture, American culture, we understand that individuals are important, but individuals always operate and make decisions in a larger context. There are other things that are happening. And institutions and systems don't impact all of us the same ways. It is important to talk about what we would call individual racism or prejudice and discrimination. And yeah, everybody is capable of being prejudiced and discriminating. But not everybody has the ability to create laws and policies. Not everyone has the ability to shape our daily social practices and expectations. And so since we don't have a more deeper understanding of how systemic and institutional racism function, we end up kind of talking past one another. So to me, the problem with officer-involved shootings of unarmed black men is not just about what did Michael Brown do, and it's not just about why didn't Eric Garner just stop flailing around. It's about that, in addition to Emmett Till, in addition to the Scottsboro Boys, in addition to fugitive slave fugitive slave capture forces, or posses rather. It's a larger history, and a lot of that history was supported by law and policy for not just years, not just decades, but centuries. And you can't say, I think it's disingenuous to make the claim that, well, we should just move on, when we don't even really have a firm understanding of what it is that we're actually moving on from. So a lot of people will get a little bit tense when issues of slavery come up, and they'll make the claim, well, we've dealt with that. You know, we had the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. We had the Civil Rights Act, so on and so forth. And all that's totally true. But really, what exactly do you know about slavery? You know, what do you know in terms of how it had an impact in not only shaping our social, political, economic relations at the time, but how did those events and actions reverberate across time to put us to where we are today? Like they always say, the past is prologue, and if you don't know your past, you don't know your future. And we as a society, and the Southern Poverty Law Center just recently released a report showing that our understanding of racism in this country is woefully pathetic, and we don't understand it. And for an institution that lasted for hundreds of years in this country, and as I said, shaped so much about this country, why we don't understand it to any considerable depth is mind-boggling. But it's something that needs to change, and it's a part of the things that we ought to be doing as a society to push us further in our understanding of race and how we get along with one another, if that's really what your goal is.
What it's reminding me of is where you talked about students who would say, why didn't I learn that in school? And where that kind of attitude leads.
Yeah, that's always kind of an interesting phenomenon. It's many of us know that students are going to say that at some point. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, it's still always kind of jarring to hear that in K-12 education specifically, these more challenging topics don't really come up, and they're substituted with conversations about, you know, human diversity and, you know, we're all the same, you know, we all bleed red, you know, those kinds of cliches. And again, I don't want to say that that's not important. It's definitely important to recognize those ideas, but again, that's just the introduction. If racism is not just whether or not you think that someone is lesser than you are because of their skin color, that's a part of it. It's also how different groups are positioned in society and how systems and institutions have an impact on various groups. So just as a quick example, when you think of something like residential segregation, you know, there's a very clear, incontrovertible history as to why neighborhoods look the way they do. And a lot of that had to do with FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, establishing property value rates. It had to deal with the practice of redlining, the practice of blockbusting. And once you get into the 70s and 80s, you know, there's an attempt that's made to say, well, I just don't really like living there in that neighborhood. But that's always connected to who are the people moving into the neighborhood, you know, and it says even more about how much we don't really know each other. You know, we might think we do, but we don't really. And we don't take the, at least in the 70s and 80s, and I would even argue even in some instances today, we don't really take the time to get to know our neighbors across racial and ethnic lines. You know, when was the last time you sat down and had dinner with someone who lives in your neighborhood or attends your child's school who doesn't look like you and who maybe doesn't come from the same economic status as you, who doesn't have the same ethnicity as you? How often do we really do that? And if we don't begin to dive a little bit deeper and listen to what each other's saying about one another's experiences, then we're doomed to repeating this merry-go-round that we're on when it comes to race relations.
You have students who question whether white privilege is real.
Yes.
You know, hey, I grew up poor. I've got challenges too. Your answer was a logical punch in the gut in the book, I think. Would you mind reading that part?
Many of my colleagues and I are constantly interrogated about the legitimacy of white privilege. Oftentimes, white students will say that they struggle just like everyone else, and that is proof that they are not privileged. I ask them, is racism real? To which most of them respond affirmatively. Then I ask, if racism is real, who benefits from it, cumulatively? And then I have them look at a bevy of statistics, from incarceration rates to death penalty sentences and exonerations due to DNA evidence, unemployment rates, the number of white CEOs in Fortune 500 companies, life expectancy rates, foreclosure rates, composition of federal and state governments, graduation rates, etc. The simplest way of proving white privilege is to have students look at the larger picture, and once they see that picture, ask, either minorities are inherently inferior to white folks to always finish behind white folks in virtually every measure we can find, or there is something else going on here. Which do you think and why?
How do they react to that?
Some are puzzled. Some have a look of, I've never really been asked that before. Some students will retreat further back and get quiet. And other students will begin to engage and feel gratified, not just non-white students, but white students as well, gratified at, you know, the opening of that door. You know, a lot of students, when they hear the term white privilege and it's explained, will have the reaction of, that's what it's called. I've always known that. Now I know how to identify it, right? And still others aren't ready to come along. But again, this is why, you know, really diving more deeply into this history in K-12 education becomes really important, because we know that before the 1600s, the concept of race as we understand it just didn't exist. It wasn't there in all of human history. We also know that the term white as a designation for a group of human beings didn't exist before then either, which means that it was created. So that kind of begs the question, well, who created it? For what purposes? And who was privileged and marginalized in that creation? And so we begin to step back and you look at American culture, early colonial America, as well as the established nation. And you see, for hundreds of years, law, policy, and social practices were designed to reiterate a racial hierarchy. That's not a spin. That's literally what happened. So if we don't understand just that basic element, that this happened and it was purposeful, then we're just continuously, you know, shadow boxing with one another and not really looking at the same problem in the same way, or at least similar perspectives. And in this age of post-truth, I'm kind of worried about where this conversation is going to go, because I can tell you that in 1681, the Virginia legislature began to pass laws that specifically stated white. I can tell you that. And then you can turn around and say, oh, well, that's just your opinion. Well, no, it's not my opinion, because we can go and we can see the record. You know, we know that there were Supreme Court cases, most notably Thind versus the United States and Ozawa versus the United States, that were all about who could be identified as white and who couldn't be. Now, what that means is that if there were actual court cases determining who could and who couldn't be white, then there was practical value to being labeled white. And that wasn't just for a couple of years, and it wasn't for a couple of decades. It was for centuries. And this notion that because, you know, we can quote Martin Luther King and affirmative action was passed in 1965, now everything is great. That's not
done.
Really
conversation
quite the way
over.
Things work.
That's, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a society, right? You know, it's with 300 plus million people. And I don't necessarily think that every person in this country has to think the same thing. But there are some things that we have to come to some kind of codified agreement upon. And if we can't even agree with an historical record that racism was created and this category of people that we know as white created itself and put itself in a position of privilege, if we can't even agree on that historical record, then we are in a lot of trouble.
Why didn't they teach us that in schools? No,
exactly.
I sound like your students. Where does that come in?
I'm of the opinion that it's cross-curricular.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I talk about how a part of the reason why it's challenging to really understand systemic and institutional racism is because we draw on an interdisciplinary matrix of subject matter. We draw on psychology, sociology, economics, political science, history, legal theory, legal history, cultural studies. I mean, we pull a lot of theories and statistics from a number of different sources. So just on its face, it's complex. It's not the kind of study that lends well to simple sound bites and ditto sheets. You know, we have to engage people. In curriculum theory, we talk about what's called the spiraled curriculum. And basically, it's the idea that you can teach any subject as long as it is developmentally appropriate. So we can talk about things like prejudice, discrimination, and then systems and institutions with five-year-olds. Sesame Street does it almost every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we can have those kinds of lessons, those critical lessons, and we can help our children develop what is called racial literacy. And that's just an understanding of how to hear and deal with issues of race as they arise. We can do that with children. And as a matter of fact, it's probably best to do it with children because they haven't gotten jaded yet. And they're a lot more open to hearing about matters of justice. You know, if there's one thing that's wonderful about children is that they have a very keen sense of fairness. And recounting, you know, these old stories to them, they are keenly aware of what's fair and what's foul. But if we don't take a concerted effort, teachers, administrators, curriculum developers, activists, et cetera, with pushing the need for standards and teaching practices that promote these critical explorations, then we're going to keep having the same conversation again and again and again. Now, I understand, having said that, that some of the subject matter is really challenging. It is not easy to hear the reality of the ravages of slavery, and I take that. However, I also think that we have to question, where does our resistance come from? You know, any given person out there who thinks that children shouldn't be exposed to these kinds of ideas, where does your resistance actually come from? What are you really afraid of in that conversation? And I've come to find that oftentimes people are afraid of questioning their own positionality within society. And to go back to the notion of white privilege, a part of what's challenging about using the term in and of itself, let alone teaching it, is that privilege is really just a way of encapsulating the benefit that one receives from any kind of oppressive system, any system of oppression. So there's male privilege, thinking about gender. There's cis privilege, thinking about sexual identity. There is able-bodiedness, thinking about physical ability. There's classism, you know, thinking about the difference between being economically well-off and economically struggling. And oftentimes when white folks get resistant about the term white privilege, then they go and say things like, well, I've had to work hard all my life. I don't get anything for free. I struggled. You know, my parents went through X, Y, and Z. They're actually really talking about class privilege. They're not talking about racial privilege. And they're different. And at the same time, do a really strange, weird, acrobatic dance with one another. To a certain degree, you can't have racism without classism. And classism reinforces racism. Racism reinforces classism. So it's convoluted that way. So it's not so much that white privilege doesn't exist. It's just that a lot of white folks who are privileged racially aren't necessarily privileged economically, and they conflate the two.
You introduce us to the term white fatigue.
Yeah.
How is white fatigue connected to the terms that are people are more familiar with, the white resistance, white guilt, white fragility?
Mm-hmm.
What is white fatigue?
Well, I define white fatigue as a quasi form of resistance in which white folks who our understanding of the moral imperative of anti-racism, or understanding of the idea that racism is wrong, yet seem to withdraw in conversations about race because of a lack of understanding about how racism functions. So white fatigue is just this notion that those who are understanding, white folks who are understanding that racism is wrong, yet struggle with understanding how institutional and systemic racism function, which is much more challenging than we should treat each other equally, right? You know, we shouldn't be prejudiced or discriminate against one another. And it kind of connects back to, well, it does connect directly back to this notion that we all go through a process of racial identity development, whether we're consciously aware of it or not, it happens. And there are various stages to all of the development models. And there is a white identity development model. And the first half of that model is marked with resistance. But then some folks are able to take a turn and begin to think a little bit more deeply and a little bit more critically about how race plays out in their own lives. And eventually, over time, and with sustained engagement and conversation and crossing borders and boundaries to get to know others, et cetera, once you begin to understand that positionality, you move in that sense of identity. And you begin to understand that a lot of the problems that we have, we're kind of supposed to have those problems. We're, you know, the system's called racism. So when it comes to racial issues, it stands to reason that we would be divided. But I think one of the things that I began to recognize as I started thinking more and more about systemic and institutional racism is that if we're defining racism as a system of advantage based on race, which is how most social scientists define it, then we have to recognize that we're all caught up in this system. I am as a black man, you are as a white woman, and whatever identity you are, you're caught up in a system that has been running long before any of us were even born. But unfortunately, it is our yoke to deal with it. And white folks have an important role in that, not only as a matter of numbers, but also as being part of the lineage of people that created it in the first place. Now, I know that that means, and I would not claim that any given white person out there driving to work or in their cars listening to this show, you know, I'm not saying that you owned slaves or anything that. But what I am saying is that perhaps, and maybe this is important to think about, perhaps even though you might feel that racism is wrong, and you might even get frustrated or tired of having this conversation again and again and again, maybe the way to look at it is, if we're continuing to have this conversation again and again and again, and we keep coming back to the same place again and again and again, then perhaps we should be listening for something different. Perhaps we should be pushing ourselves to understand where other folks are coming from and why they would continue to have these same arguments. It's not healthy or productive to assume that if an African-American male is detained by the police that he's automatically up to no good. Because I know a lot of people who are professors, and other professionals who were doing nothing and minding their own business and being hassled by police officers. And saying that, I recognize that there are a whole lot of police officers out there who are doing a damn good job, a great job at protecting and serving us. So this is not a bash on law enforcement in and of itself, but there's a trend there, and it's not a new trend. Ta-Nehisi Coates said, the violence isn't new, it's the cameras that are new, you know. So we can go back to many different periods and see how African Americans were targeted specifically. And if you don't believe me, look up William Parker, Los Angeles Police Department, 1950s. He was the chief of police of Los Angeles, and he recruited a segregationist to the police force in LA to deal with the black problem, and he did not use the word black. So there are a lot of us that know that that history is there. I'm only using this as an example because it's really high in the news right now, but Chicago PD, 2015 Department of Justice report showed that there was rampant racism running throughout the Chicago PD, as well as the Baltimore Police Department, Ferguson Police Department. That's just three, right? New York City, NYPD, and their stop and frisk policy was deemed unconstitutional. And their stop and frisk policy had a far more deleterious effect on black and Latinos than it did on white folks, even though white folks are of a high population in the city, in New York. So these kinds of things aren't answered by simply saying people deserved it, or they must have been doing something wrong, or, you know, we can explain black unemployment because, oh, well, they're just lazy. Because if you actually go inside low-income, predominantly black communities, you find that a lot of people are working very hard to provide for their families. They're just stuck in spaces that lack opportunity and real civic investment, you know? And so what do you do in those situations? So what I tell my students is that they have to understand that there are a lot of moving parts that are happening all at the same time. And dealing with that complexity can, for some students, produce this notion of frustration, which can then produce this feeling of fatigue. It's not so much that they're resistant to these ideas, it's just that there's so much and it comes at them in so many waves that after a while you're just like, oh my God, this is much bigger than I ever thought it was.